My name's Nick Hilliard. I work for a small non-governmental organisation called The Corner House, which is a research and solidarity group focusing on human rights, environment and development. Does the crisis stem from deregulation? Well, up to a point, yes, but only up to a point. It's certainly true that many of the regulations that, for example, separated investment banking from high street banking were scrapped as part of the neoliberal agenda. It's certainly true that there was deregulation of controls on the derivatives market, which was very significant to the crisis. But I think it's a little bit simplistic simply to see it in terms of regulation versus deregulation. There are other things going on outside of the banking sector that very much arose from the neoliberal agenda that were very pertinent to the crisis, not least the wholesale financialization of large parts of the economy, the withdrawal of the state from the provision of key public services, the increasing reliance on financial markets by the productive economy in order to keep up yield and so on. These were all key factors too. And I think it's important to remember that at the time of, say, Big Bang, which certainly had a deregulatory element, there were also about 800 new regulations imposed on the formal banking system. And what you saw in those years afterwards was actually the emergence of the shadow banking system, which exploited not only the difference in regulation between different countries, regulatory arbitrage, but also the niches that were thrown up by both the new regulation and the deregulation. And by the first years of this century, that shadow banking system was providing about 50% of the credit for the economy. I mean, this was a major banking sector in its own right. And of course, many of the techniques flooded into the formal banking sector. So you had their own proprietary trading desks and so on. Many banks began to act in many senses like hedge funds, for example. So I think it's a more complex process than just, oh well, they deregulated, and therefore the answer must be new regulation. The key question is regulation by whom, for what, who controls the regulatory agenda, what's the purpose of it? And those are very big questions, particularly at a time when the banking sector, in effect, has not just been bailed out by the state, but has in many ways taken over the state. And you see RBS, for example, state run, but very little change in the way that it actually works, even though it is in common ownership. Well, I think that the international organizations can play a role, for sure. But a regulation that actually brings finance back under public control for the public good is going to require a good deal more than relying on a top-down approach by major international organizations or indeed national governments, effectively relying simply on legislating for change in the way that finance is done. And one of the reasons for that is that you can't legislate for cultural change. And the culture of many banks, hedge funds, private equity funds, and so on, is actually not about obeying the letter of every single regulation. It's about making money out of arbitraging regulation. It's about making money out of using derivatives and other mechanisms for getting around regulation. It's a culture which looks at conflicts of interest as a synergy. It's a culture that looks at new regulation as an opportunity to make money. And that culture springs from the institutional form. And you can't legislate for that. You've got to build new, different institutions. And that, from my money, means much more a question of social movement building, of building from the bottom up, of learning from from past efforts to build, for example, mutual societies and so on and so forth, actually reclaiming finance from the bottom up. To expect real structural change from the sort of legislative and regulatory agenda that proposals that are on the agenda at the moment, I think is very wishful thinking. I mean, take for example what's been going through Congress at the moment in the US, or what's proposed in the EU. The real preoccupation behind the regulatory change is to get to a position where the taxpayer would not be in a position in the future to have to bail out banks. That's a preoccupation of the governments. And that is very different preoccupation to actually trying to reclaim finance for the public good, so that it actually serves public social needs, so that it entrenches and reinforces solidarity in communities and so on and so forth. That's a different form of finance. And the sort of regulatory outcomes from the changes that are proposed, for example, putting more derivatives on exchanges, the reality is that this may well create not just banks that are too big to fail, but exchanges that are too big to fail. The regulatory changes that increase the entry costs into the hedge fund business, for example, will mean that hedge funds become bigger and bigger and bigger. So you create hedge funds that are too big to fail. So it's a regulatory agenda that is not creating real structural change. And I think for that, the issue is partly about building new institutions from the bottom up, partly about reclaiming existing institutions, and partly about addressing issues outside of the banking sector. To give you one example, why in the past year in Britain, the 300 council houses built by public authorities, there are about 4 million people on public housing waiting lists. Now, if you rely entirely on the private sector to do your house building for you, you are going to have to rely on instruments like securitization simply to recycle the money for them to fulfill that role of building all the houses. If you withdraw the state from provision of other public services as well, you know, education, health, and it's no coincidence that I think that one of the rebounding private equity industry is looking more and more to go into health and education and those sorts of sectors to mop up what's sloughed off during the cuts. You are going to have to rely on financial markets basically speculating to create the sheer amount of money that's needed to do those sorts of jobs. Companies are not in the position of a government. A government can tax. A government can raise revenue. And if you want to cool down the markets, to cool down speculation, it is about taking out from the markets many of the functions that they're now expected to perform. So, rethinking pensions so that pensions aren't reliant on financial markets to provide for pensioners' old age. So, rethinking public housing so that much more public housing is done by the state through cooperatives, through other mechanisms, and so on and so forth. It's about certainly not going down the route of trying to address, for example, climate change through creating a $1 trillion carbon market. It's about scaling down finance, not expecting the private sector to do everything through financial markets. It means moving away from relying on financial markets, relying on financialization to generate the wealth, the investment to address what are essential public services. It means redressing the withdrawal of the state from the provision of essential public services. It means rethinking what the role of the state should be in the future in terms of in terms of providing for essential public goods. And I think that raises a whole debate about what we mean by the state, the role of the state, the public good, who defines a public interest, who defines a public good, what sorts of new social organization that isn't just the old-fashioned bureaucratic state running our public services, but new forms of governance, new forms of managing public services that very much involve citizens and so on. But it is essentially about recognizing that you will have crisis after crisis if you rely on financial markets to provide for your essential services. One of the chilling ironies, really, of the financial crisis is the way that it has metamorphosed from a crisis that was about the banking sector, about the free market economy, into a crisis where the public is having to pay for the excesses of the banking system and the financial system in more generally. And that is being translated into cuts because of a fear of the sovereign debt crisis and so on. I think that it is precisely that moment where the public sector is being crushed potentially through these cuts that the opportunity comes to mobilize and campaign and to mobilize a movement that reclaims the public, that reclaims the state, that reclaims finance for the public. And that is a political political project. It's not about just regulation. It's about mobilizing people. It's about bringing home possible alternatives, tax rather than cuts, for example. Clamping down on tax havens, which in itself would generate a large proportion of the alleged deficit that we face. It's about working with people to build their own institutions that quite often maybe a mix of public and private, a collective, for example, a cooperative, for example, and those sorts of political mobilization are happening all over the places. They're happening with people setting up their own credit unions. They're happening with people setting up cooperatives to finance what the banks aren't willing to lend for. They're happening with people thinking through alternative energy and how to finance it. They're happening with people talking about municipal bonds and raising money for municipal enterprises through that sort of mechanism. There's a lot of conversations going on that need to be built on. But I think there is a real danger that if all these attempts by people to reclaim finance for the public are very fragmented and do not take on this broader issue of the withdrawal of the state from public services and so on, there will be a fragmentation that may not create the political momentum and the political weight to counter what is one of the most powerful lobbies in the world, the financial lobby.